Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Anti-war radio, in a manner of speaking. Today on the show, Trita Parsi will be here. He was there for the Iran talks in Geneva. You guys know Trita, right? He's from the National Iranian American Council. He's not a libertarian. I don't think he's really a progressive either. I guess foreign policy-wise, he's likes to line up with the realist school more than anything, right? Something. But he's been good on, hey, let's negotiate and normalize relations with Iran for a long, long time. And, you know, I was following him on Twitter on Saturday night. In breathless anticipation, you know, I'm following him and Ali Gharib and Reza Mirashi, of course, and Barbara Slavin and Laura Rosen and Scott Peterson from the Christian Science Monitor and some of these other journalists waiting to find out what the hell are they going to sign a deal or not? Sign a damn deal. And then when they sign it, there's this great picture of Trita Parsi and Reza Mirashi, both from NIAC, there with these huge smiles on their faces, you know, as they're celebrating. And then Ali Gharib was mocking Jeffrey Goldberg, talking about, we're all going to go have drinks in your honor, dude, and all this kind of stuff. And, well, you know, if you're interested in Iran stuff and you like Twitter, it was a great time. It was fun. But so, anyway, I'm trying to not stay too delusional or anything. It's a good thing I keep Gareth Porter around, because I like being positive and optimistic if I have a good reason to be, but anyway. I think Trita has a very positive attitude about what's going on. So Gareth was here to rain on our parade yesterday. Then again, I think he's maybe a bit too cynical at this point. I don't know. There's obviously, it ain't going to be easy. This is not the, you know, Nixon goes to China and there's no way to take that back. This is take backable. As David Petraeus would say, fragile and reversible, meaning he never accomplished anything. Except a snow job on you. But anyway, to adopt that phrase. The deal with Iran is fragile and reversible. But anyway, so Trita's going to be here, and he didn't have much time, but I understand he must be very busy this week. But we're going to talk with him actually just here in a few minutes about what he sees as the prospects for peace and for Iran's future, too. There's your sneak preview of the interview. Those are the two questions for him. All right. And then other than that, I actually didn't do a very good job of lining up a show today. I tried to reach Alexa O'Brien because she wrote this great thing about the trial of Chelsea Manning at the Cairo Review, which I don't know anything about. But anyway, she's great, man. Good old Alexa O'Brien. Hey, and Bradley Chelsea Manning, she's great too. I don't care what gender you call yourself. That's an American hero right there. And it's really too bad that the media has done such a good job of, well, they never really did a good job of making Manning look bad. But you know what they did succeed in doing? Is making it look like everybody else thought they had done a good job of showing what a bad guy he was or what a bad thing he did. Right? They did a good job of pushing the theory that this was the consensus. They never even really tried to make a case. A young person under stress makes a very risky decision as an act of conscience. There's just no denying it. So they just kind of skipped denying it and went straight to everybody looks on him in distaste. How could you do such a thing? And then that was the only argument that they had to win, was that the majority disagrees with you if you disagree with that. And that can be really powerful, can't it? I remember watching Jake Tapper, who I actually consider to be, you know, from all the goofballs on cable TV news, he actually does journalism. I mean, Phil Giraldi, remember, was on the show and talked all about Tapper's book, where he was embedded with these soldiers in extremely dangerous war zones. So he's not just an anchor. He's a journalist of some kind. A TV one. An author. A war reporter. And I remember him asking about Ed Snowden when the Edward Snowden NSA leaks first came out. And saying, well, you know, everybody hates Bradley Manning, but, you know, this Snowden guy, what about him? You think they'll see him as any different? Like, whoa, what are you talking about? Everybody hates Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning is the greatest American hero ever. How do you like that, Jake Tapper? What the hell are you talking about? The Iraq and Afghan war logs? He's the best thing. Just those two things right there. Never mind the entire saga with WikiLeaks and whatever. Makes him the greatest source of journalism in the 21st century. He's the biggest deal ever. You know how many articles have been based out of the Iraq and Afghan war logs and the State Department cables? Or if not based entirely on them, reference them as it says in the State Department documents, blah, blah, blah. There's got to be 10,000 articles like that. Huge stories. Current and future history of the world altering stories. Out of an act of conscience. Keep someone liberating secrets that the government had no right to keep. But somehow, that's just the consensus, huh? That nobody ever heard of any of that. Just Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning. Oh, even more so, right? He already was a terrible person. Oh, now he wants to get a sex change. Oh, now talk about abnormal. Talk about can't relate with that. Talk about, I saw on CNN, Jake Tapper said, we all hate this guy already anyway. And now he's some kind of sex freak. Okay. Well, there's Alexa O'Brien. She's telling the truth, if you're interested in that. About who Manning is, what she did, and why. And what it all means. It's a great piece, I admit. I'm kind of glad that she didn't email me back because I only got halfway through it before I got distracted this morning and didn't get a chance to get back to it. But she's done a lot of great work on the story of Bradley Manning, and I hope that, probably not this week, maybe tomorrow. But certainly I will interview Alexa O'Brien about this great article. If it has to wait till next week, then that's fine too. Right. And by the way, as long as we're on that subject for a minute here, it's an extremely important development. It's an extremely important development. Check it out, man. Fucking, there's a thing here happened. In, I think it was the Washington Post. Yeah, Washington Post. Julian Assange unlikely to face U.S. charges over publishing classified documents. So it's already, I believe, a more or less pseudo-known fact that they have impaneled a grand jury. I think they acknowledge that in here, that they have a grand jury, but that they're going to get a no bill or they're just going to drop it. And here's the thing about that. They want to prosecute Julian Assange for espionage. All right? But, as they concede here, if Julian Assange is guilty of espionage, then the Washington Post is guilty of espionage, and the New York Times is guilty of espionage, and the Guardian is guilty of espionage. And just, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times, those guys might as well be J. Edgar Hoover's secret files, right? You think about it, they've got the entire state by the short and curlies. They can do whatever they want with them if they want to. You can't really take on the New York Times because really, push comes to shove, they're more powerful. Sort of. I mean, actually, the government could go in there, kill them all, and get away with it, right? but the Post would write about it, and that could be problematic. And really, you know, the whole Congress, the whole government is full of psychopaths with all kinds of skeletons in their closets that the Times and the Post have seen, I mean, personal type ones, that the Times and the Post have seen fit to not publish and highlight all this time. I'm trying to remember who I'm plagiarizing when I say that you don't pick a fight with people who buy their ink by the oil tanker full, because they'll bury you. And now, a hilarious irony here, a most important part of this story, is that the Post and the Times have both officially forsaken Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Oh, do whatever you want to the girl, but leave us alone. In that case, I was plagiarizing the heroic George Carlin, of course. But they said, oh, yeah, no, Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, yeah, what they're doing, that's different than what we do. Why, he publishes the documents on the website. We write stories about documents and then publish them on the website. So, yeah, go ahead and take Julian Assange and crucify him and drown him in the sea, do whatever you want. Just please don't hurt us. I think those were Bill Keller's exact words, actually. You might go back and look it up and see how close I got it. I'm going from memory, but pretty sure that's what he said. But in the Justice Department, I guess somebody red-teamed this for a minute, and they asked the question, hey, man, really? We've had this thing in America always where the leaker can get in trouble, but the reporter who gets his hand on the document, those are the breaks, government. The document got all the way to the reporter. Now the reporter can publish. And never mind any of this nonsense about, did they pass this thing where Dianne Feinstein is trying to define down journalist? But of course, journalist is anyone who's even considering writing something or saying something where someone else can hear it. Give me a break. There's no more narrow definition of that. The only reason somebody needs a press pass is so they're allowed past, you know, under a matter of privilege, they're allowed to cross a police line or something like that, where the police have the presumed natural, you know, or not natural, but presumed civil authority to prevent someone else coming. They'll say, well, but if you have a press pass, you can come, something like that. But in no case has anyone ever in the history of American jurisprudence that I've ever heard of said that the government gets to define what journalism is, who a journalist is, as more narrow than anyone who's thinking of documenting anything about anything. I claim that I was going to report to, what, two people? Do I need to have an audience of two? I was going to report to two people the shape of one of the leaves in my yard. There, I'm a reporter. I'm a journalist. Because, of course, people presumably, I don't know if I can prove this, but it's self-evident that they're born screaming and they got the natural right to say whatever they want. And so any civil protections of people to do just that are the result of that natural right and free people insisting that those natural rights are protected. Huh? The same reason I got the right to be a preacher in whichever sect I choose. It's not because they say so. Well, I guess in practice it is, isn't it? And hell, yes, the average American conservative, they'd be all in favor of outlawing every branch of Protestantism and every other religion except their own, without thinking for a minute that they are at the same time granting that authority to others over their own life too. But anyway, trying to define down who's a journalist, give me a break. Let's see, if a government employee liberates 20,000 documents and hands them to a blogger, and let's just pretend that Glenn Greenwald had never written anything more than, I don't know, a 100-word blog entry about nothing before. Say, about Jerry Seinfeld. And then Snowden gave all these documents to him, and then Greenwald did his first original story for The Guardian based on that. He's a journalist as soon as he begins thinking of publishing in The Guardian at that point. The first possible moment. And so, anyway, this is huge. This is a really big deal. That they're backing down, apparently. This is not 100%. The formal decision has not yet been made. Oh, they do, again, yes, they do confirm there is a grand jury investigating WikiLeaks there. But they got no crime. And remember now, this is part of why they tortured Bradley Manning, was to try to get Bradley Manning to flip and turn state's witness against Julian Assange and lie and pretend that Julian Assange had told him to liberate these documents in the first place. Again, this is supposed to be part of an espionage case. But if a reporter, if any other reporter, like, say, I don't know, my wife, says to one of her sources, hey, get me this document, that's called being a journalist. That's not a conspiracy to commit an act of espionage, get me this document. So even then, they got nothing. But this was what they were trying to beat out of Chelsea Manning. Was testimony against false testimony, perjured testimony against Julian Assange, so they could try to pretend that a journalist asking for a story from a source instead of just being a passive recipient of one makes that person involved in espionage against the United States. That journalist guilty of espionage. I'm telling you, man, Roseanne Barr said it right the other day on her Twitter thing. She was talking about the nuclear option taking away the filibuster in the Senate. But she just called Obama a dictator. Said all the if Bush had done this, got rid of the filibuster, they'd have flipped. Every liberal blogger, every liberal wonk, the entire Center for American Progress and the rest would have completely blown their tops. But it's dictator Obama, and all of a sudden, all principle goes out the window. Maybe they never had any at all. A lot of that's going on here. Well, you know, I don't know, man. Didn't you learn when you were a real little kid that you might have a whim, and you might want to see the police enforce it, but you know, if you have the right to, this was mine, I say take the golf courses away from all the rich idiots that want to play golf all day and give them to poor people. I came up with that before George Carlin even. That was why I liked George Carlin so much, is because he thought just like me. And someone wise, probably my mom, said, yeah, but of course it's the golfers that rule the world, son. And if people just have the right to take away what other people want to do, they're going to be the ones taking away your skateboard, get it? So, if you endorse the unlimited power of the state to enforce who gets to do what on their own property with their own life, you're the one who's going to lose. Mr. Leave Me Alone, Skateboarding's Not a Crime. And then, I guess what? It took me one try to understand that, right? Not 100 tries. Like, oh, maybe instead of wishing for a totalitarian police state that acts just the way I would like it to act, maybe I could acknowledge there's no such thing as that. There are totalitarian police states, but only the kind that would hurt me instead. I'm going to choose liberty for myself and others instead. Yeah. Welcome to self-evident natural liberty. Welcome to reason. I was 10. I'm not sure how old you are now, but I'm glad you caught on, finally. All right, Trita next.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, Al Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. Hey, Al Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And it looks like our one and only guest today will be Trita Parsi. That's all right. That's a good one. Trita Parsi, he's the founder and the president of NIAC, the National Iranian American Council. That's NIACouncil.org. Just back from Geneva, Switzerland, where he was covering the successful, for now at least, Iran talks. Welcome to the, back to the show, Trita. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. Very happy to have you here on the show, and we only have a short amount of time. I know you're very busy, so I'll just go ahead and ask a real quick three-part. First of all, could you tell us very briefly the form of the deal? I know people are, as you know, people are hearing a lot of spin about, what a terrible deal this is or something. So if you could just give us a very brief outline, which would obviously dispel that in a moment. And then I'd like to hear about your optimism, which I know you have, about the prospects for peace here and the success of a long-term deal. And then I would reference, if we had a minute at the end, your piece in Reuters about the future of Iran that hangs in the balance with this foreign deal with the United States. So yeah. The floor is yours, sir.
So, yeah, first of all, this is quite an achievement, frankly. This is a great deal because we have taken a very complex issue, divided it in two, created a first phase in which the Iranians give most of the concessions, and they're seizing the most sensitive activities that they're doing. And essentially, by stopping 20%, they really don't have much of a path to a nuclear weapon. They're not expanding the program during this period. They're getting rid of their stockpile of 20% enriched uranium. And for that, they're getting some minor sanctions relief. And then we have to go to the second phase. In the second phase, Iran is going to have some additional limitations to their program, but they are not going to completely eliminate it. And they are going to agree to much more intrusive inspections. And then for that, they're going to get, first of all, essentially a recognition that they have a nuclear program, and secondly, they're going to get most of the sanctions lifted, the ones that are nuclear-related. And that is, a smart process toward getting this resolved. Those people who are shouting out Munich and surrender have absolutely no clue what they're talking about, particularly mindful of the fact that many of them were in favor of the Bush administration's approach, and it was the Bush administration's approach to actually enable the Iranians to expand their program as much as they did.
Okay, and then, later in the show, I'm actually going to go through and dispel the individual myths. John Glazer has done a real great job of that over at antiwar.com today about, the right-wingers are saying that they're getting a bunch of taxpayer money out of the Treasury rather than some of their own money back. Just little stuff, but we can skip that.
Yeah.
Talk to me about what you think about the prospects for a final deal here. I'll go ahead and preface that a little bit with Gareth Porter's reporting. He's focused mostly on the negative tone of some of the statements from the State Department now. Well, we'll see whether we can do this, where, geez, why are they sounding so negative, just a few days after achieving so much? And he says, it's hard for government departments to give up dominance over another state like they have here.
Look, there's going to be problems on both sides, and there's going to be folks in the bureaucracy who probably would prefer that things are kept the way they were kept in the past, which is that, essentially there's no progress. But if that happens, if there would be a violation of this deal from the American side, I think we should be very clear what will happen. The deal will fall apart, and a lot of countries that have been supporting the sanctions will stop supporting the sanctions, because they supported the sanctions because of the belief that Iran was in the wrong. And because Iran had not done what it should have done, they agreed to sanction that country. But if we have a situation now in which actually there is a solution, and then the U.S. violates that deal because some of these spoilers on the American side, then the entire sanctions architecture and whatever it is that at this point we believe gives us leverage will fall apart. So we have very strong incentives to make sure that that doesn't happen. And unfortunately, there are those who have strong political incentives to make sure that this happens, because they actually don't care about the national interests of the United States. They just want to make sure that they create another path towards a war in the Middle East.
Yeah. On the other hand, this really is huge, too. I don't want to undersell it all. It seems like if the president was determined enough to see this thing through the way he has, there's at least, I don't know, what kind of odds would you give? He really, really wants to make sure it gets done in April now. And this is not, he doesn't want to let it fall apart like the temporary freeze from 03 to 05 and proceed, you know, further down the path of conflict.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's the fact that a historic deal has been made, and at the same time, the administration has to go out there and defend it against accusations of Munich,
yeah,
is ridiculous. Look at what the Iranians are doing. The Iranians actually gave more concessions in this round, and they're celebrating it on the streets in Iran.
Right.
Because they realize they've won something, and they don't have any hiccups to be able to express that. Instead of celebrating what the U.S. has won, we are in a situation in which we're under some sort of illusion that we've lost something. It's absolutely bizarre. It's really bizarre, but it also shows the difficulty of actually conducting effective foreign policy right now, because you have constantly maximalists that are accusing every positive step of being not good enough, and as a result, it's a betrayal. That's what paralyzes the U.S. government, because it doesn't dare to do anything. It's better to do nothing than to do something and be accused of betrayal.
Right. All right, I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Trita Parsi, and now you have this piece yesterday in Reuters, blogs.reuters.com, Iran's Future is Now. What do you mean by that?
Well, this was their title. What my title was that this is so much more than just enrichment. This nuclear deal, at the end of the day, will not just determine what number of enrichment they will have, etc., but rather will help determine who decides what Iran is in the next few decades. Will Iran be defined by people like Ahmadinejad and their confrontational style and their angry and upsetting rhetoric? Or will it be defined by the moderate, constructive, and much more open approach of Rouhani and Zarif? This is not just about enrichment. This will color every other field of Iran's interaction. And if you have an Iran that actually is much more defined and guided by the values and principles of Rouhani and Zarif, it's going to be a game changer in the Middle East, not just because of issues such as Syria or collaboration in the Persian Gulf, resolving Afghanistan and Iraq, but also internally, in the sense that this is going to give a huge boost to those inside the country for so long and so courageously have fought for greater political freedoms. That's why they're celebrating in Iran right now. They realize this is much more than just a nuclear deal.
Right. All right, everybody, that is Trita Parsi. He's the founder and the president of the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. Thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, everybody. It's the Scott Horton Show. We'll be right back after this. I got all kinds of news today. Syria talks, National Security Agency, Libya, Palestine. Hang tight.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. So, good news. The website, scotthorton.org, is continuing to get better. And there have been some real problems with the whole show feed, for example, since last February. Man, all this genius stuff, I don't even know the words for it all and whatever, but all I'm saying is damn thing was broken, the RSS feed, and then there was this archive and that one, and they weren't really working together right. And everything said slash category slash something else instead of just slash something else. Anyway, point being, it's getting fixed. The site is getting fixed. And I even, I'm going to have kind of a custom job on the front page there where it's even more good-er. And then I'm going to start adding slash this, that, and the other thing. I'm going to have slash articles for all the articles I've ever written. I'm going to have slash, you know, copied and pasted there and whatever. I'm going to have slash bookstore for, you know, all of my recommended reading, and then, you know, see if I can make a couple nickels off of Amazon commissions and all that kind of stuff. I'm going to try to have a clone of the Liberty Stickers website, only with mine and not all the other ones. And then on and on like that. And then I've swore to myself, too, that I'm going to kick Facebook and hopefully Twitter, too, like I did cigarettes almost, I shouldn't really celebrate yet, but almost 2 years ago now I quit smoking cigarettes. It's probably why y'all don't like me anymore, because I'm not as good of a person as I used to be. Nicotine and me, we go back a long way. It's sort of part of who I am, but without it, I'm less of what I was. Only I'll live longer, so. Anyway. But I'm going to quit that Facebook, and I'm going to put everything I actually really got to say on stress, and it's going to push out to Facebook, and then it's going to be cool again. It used to be a lot of people would hang out over at the stress blog, and my site was actually kind of a thing. Now it's kind of a ghost town. People go and they sign up for the archives, but that's about it. But that's going to change, god dang it. So, keep your eye on scotthorton.org. It's going to get better. By the way, the custom job for the front page there, I talked to all of my computer geniuses, and none of them can do it except this one guy who's a level, I don't know, 15 or whatever the hell kind of guy, and he's got to do it for money. So, if that makes you feel like donating, feel free to. And by the way, boy, am I taking bitcoins right now, huh? Just go to scotthorton.org/donate. That page always works. scotthorton.org/donate. Anybody donates $100 or more, and I will send you one of those QR code commodity discs, which I think are so cool, man. That's as cool as a bitcoin for sure. A silver, 1 ounce, round, with a QR code on the back so that when you scan it, with your smartphone, it tells you exactly how much it's worth instantaneously. On the market, you know, the current market price to the moment. denominated now in dollars, but soon enough in whatever you want. To me, I think that's the future currency for the world. If I was the market, it's what I would choose. I'm only one teeny tiny part of the market, but I like it. Them QR code discs. And anyway, by the way, everyone who's donated $100 or more and that I sent one of those to that I've heard back from anyway, they all really like them too. I think they're great, man. I really do. Check that out, commoditydiscs.com and at scotthorton.org/donate. And man, you know, I had 49 bitcoins. No. I had 12 bitcoins. And I sold them when they were worth $49 a piece to pay basic bills. And that was just like 6 months ago or something. And the good thing is I'm no good at arithmetic to tell exactly how much, it would have been 14 by now or something like that. How much that times 900 is. But I'm certain if I had had them, I would have sold at 900. And then that's a lot of money that I could have used for things. I'm always wishing I had a time machine. Makes me want to go to RockyMountainMiners.com and get one of them computers that mines Litecoins. They're the wave of the future, man. Is it the way of the future or the wave of the future? ScottHorton.org/donate. If you want to help pay for the cost of the new front page for ScottHorton.org that doesn't exist yet, but will soon. That would be great. Thank you very much. Okay, so now, more Iran stuff. I'm going to get to the dispelling some of those myths, that great John Glazer article, here in just a minute. But first, I wanted to emphasize again what Gareth Porter was saying about the negative attitude coming out of the State Department about whether they think they can achieve a deal here. I think Gareth's bad attitude is probably the most realistic one. Now, Trita Parsi, he's happy as hell about this deal, but he seemed pretty resigned, too, to what a tough fight it's going to be to see this thing through. But anyway, I don't know, maybe that's motivation for people to try to, I don't know, do you know anybody's rich? Like, maybe your uncle's a millionaire, and he knows the guy at the big firm or something, and they know some Democrats or some Republicans or something. Somehow, somebody out there has got to get the word out that, hey, we really need this deal. You know, come on. This would be the one thing this piece of crap president ever did right in his whole crappy life. Come on, man. Do the deal. You know? Can we get that meme out there? Come on, man. Do the deal. Somebody make a picture and spread it on Twitter. Do the deal. To think here I am, arguing on the side of Zbigniew Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger and Brent Scowcroft. What does that tell you? When the old establishment wise men, wise guys, are saying, do the deal. Do a deal. Hey, do the deal. Do the deal. Do the deal, they say. Brzezinski and Kissinger and Scowcroft. That's the national security advisors, right? That's the top level of the old Rockefeller men. So, it's them and everyone versus the Israelis on this one. The question is, really, and this is really important, and I'm not one to recommend voting or anything like that. It's just a matter of public sentiment here. You know? What is it that the people want here? If the people want, whatever, I don't care. Or, oh yeah, tell me another scary story about an EMP turning off all the lights, or some kind of nonsense. You know, then I guess we're kind of screwed. But if what the people want is, yeah, we're sick and tired of all this crap about Iran. Go ahead and do the deal and put this thing to bed. If that's what the people want, that's what we'll get. Even on the Iran issue. You know, that's what Alan Grayson said about Syria. That guy, Alan Grayson, I don't know if you guys are familiar with my history with the guy, but he is one to go along with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, to put it mildly. And he was asked, man, how can you come out so hardcore against the thing in Syria when this is what AIPAC wants? And he said, hey, you know what? AIPAC is AIPAC. But when the American people make their voice heard, this is what he said. When the American people make their voice heard, AIPAC falls to the wayside. And he's right to imply that the AIPAC is not the American people. They are agents of a foreign power. They are a fifth column in our country. And what they want is what's good for what they think is good for a foreign country. And they don't care about ours at all. So, it's going to take, you know, I don't know, talk to your minister about it. And say, hey, you know what, I was really studying up this Iran thing, and I really think you ought to take a look at this and maybe give a talk about it. Right? I don't know. Anybody listening have a TV show? I don't know. What do you got to do to get people behind us? People say, hell no, to Syria. Hell no, we don't. No, don't bomb them. Don't bomb them. They had to call it off. They could do the same thing with this Iran thing. We want a damn deal. Sign the thing. Sign the thing. If that's what the people are saying, it'll get done. You know? I'm not saying democracy's great or whatever, or this even is one. I'm just saying, you know what? Even in the Soviet Union, ultimately the people got what they wanted. You know? Democracy or not. Here. I gotta remember at the next break to try to send this thing. The custom front page. It's gonna have all these different elements from different parts of the site showing like the last few entries of this and that. And in the theme we got, WordPress doesn't make it easy. You gotta be able to write some stuff, pretty fancy stuff. That's what I understand about it. All right. Huh. Did they change it? Yeah, no, man. Ain't that something? I'm always trying to help the poor people at McClatchy Newspapers title and headline their stories, right? But we just... All right. And then... Hang on 1 second. Sorry, I had to chat something on the damn live radio show. All right, stop it. We'll go see what time about this later. All right, it's the show. I'm Scott Horton. And now, so Bob at Facebook said to me, hey, Scott, can you, on this Iran thing, make a comparison between this and North Korea? And I'm glad that he asked that because... the thing of it is this, I've actually seen a lot of right-wingers saying, oh yeah, this is just like North Korea, this, that, the other thing. I guess I could get to the Munich thing too. Let me put Munich here in my notes. Because that's sort of the same argument, but kind of different. Anyway, here's what really happened with North Korea, briefly, okay? The old man, at the end of the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union fell apart, and Communist China had already been basically, they're still communists, but they had been won over to be frenemies, at least, of the U.S. since the mid-70s, right? So, old man commie dictator Kim Il-sung basically rattled his saber and said, I'm going to make nukes if you don't give me a bunch of welfare money. And, you know, withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty and all this. And so Clinton went over there, and what he should have done is just paid him a lot to knock all of it down, the Soviet-built, Soviet-era plutonium-producing reactor, and just, you know, we'll buy up all of the nuclear fuel you have at whatever price you name, right? It would have been, I mean, I'm a libertarian, I'm not for any welfare for anybody, even for communists, but boy, this would have just solved everything there on the spot. But anyway... what they came up with was really a pretty fair deal. And I hate Democrats more than you, so stop calling me a liberal or something. But what they came up with was a deal, Warren Christopher, that said, look, if you promise not to operate your plutonium-producing reactor. We'll give you a light water reactor or two. Donald Rumsfeld's company will deliver them. It'll be great. Welfare for him, welfare for you. We'll give you money, and we'll give you fuel oil. And if we do all those things, you promise to stay inside the Non-Proliferation Treaty and your safeguards agreement with the IAEA. That was called the Agreed Framework. And when Bush took power, remember now how Cheney and the neocons were kind of staying quiet in the background at first during the campaign and after, right after the election. Everybody just sort of assumed that the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, was going to be the leader on all these things. And Colin Powell, of course, that wasn't the case. But anyway, Powell immediately said, yes, we are going to continue the Clinton policy. And in fact, I'm trying to remember, this may be War Made Easy by Norman Solomon. Come on, footnote in my brain. You know, I don't know. It might have been, it could have been Why We Fight by Eugene Jarecki, but no. Man. I'm sorry, y'all. I can't think of it. One of these movies, they focus on this, where Colin Powell is giving this big speech about how here are the Bush administration's foreign policies from now on, or whatever. And in the background, Dick Cheney's standing there looking at him like, yeah, right, that's what you think, you piece of S, you know? Sorry to have to say it like that. They really focused on that. But anyway, so Powell said, that's what we're going to do. You know, we're going to continue with this agreed framework. It's a pretty damn good deal and so good. But the entire rest of the administration disagreed. And, of course, they had John Bolton and David Wurmser were there as agents of Dick Cheney in the State Department there to thwart Colin Powell and do whatever they wanted anyway, to try to keep a leash on him, but also to just undermine him by acting rogue. And so what they did was... they basically invented this ridiculous lie in 2002 that, remember, this is me giving the brief version. they invented this lie in 2002 that a North Korean dignitary admitted at a cocktail party for no reason whatsoever that, yeah, by the way, we've been breaking the deal all along. We have a secret uranium enrichment program that we never told anyone about. Well, come on. Oh, he told you that, did he? By the way, there's no evidence to this day that that's the case. They do have a uranium enrichment program now. There's nothing indicating it went back all the way to the fall of 2002 like this. Come on. Well, Bush announced that we are breaking the agreed framework, unilaterally abrogating it by claiming that you have abrogated it, which was a damned lie. And they said not only, and they, you know, they had never delivered on the light water reactors, which they produce very polluted plutonium, so it's basically impossible to make nukes out of their waste, is the purpose of a light water reactor, folks. So they never got their light water reactors, they never got their fuel oil, and they never got much money, or maybe they got a little bit of fuel oil and money, but not much. We had never, our side had never really lived up to the deal anyway. But at this point, Bush broke the deal, added new sanctions, and announced the creation of the PSI, the Proliferation Security Initiative, which said, we reserve the right to seize your boats on the high seas under some brand new international laws we just made up. And then more sanctions. And so only then did North Korea withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They had been members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty all this time up to this point. Only then did they withdraw, kick out the inspectors, turn off the cameras and the sensors, turn their plutonium-producing, it's actually, I think it's a natural uranium reactor that produces weapons-grade plutonium, if I remember right, the Soviet reactor. It might run on enriched uranium, or maybe on either, or, I'm trying to remember now, I talked about this with Dr. Prather before. But anyway, they started up their Soviet-era nuclear weapons fuel-producing, waste-producing reactor, and they began their effort to make nuclear bombs. And the estimates now are that they have about six of them. They've done three tests so far. All three of them, I think, have been partial fizzles. It's very difficult to set off the implosion system, to get that right, to set off an implosion bomb. The Hiroshima bomb was a very simple, relatively, I guess, simple mechanism. It's like having a shotgun barrel in there, and you blast one piece of uranium into the other at very high speed and in just the right configuration, and you're going to get some fission out of that. They never even needed to test that bomb. They were so sure of the arithmetic that that one was going to come out right. Okay, it was algebra. But the Nagasaki bomb, and that's what was made out of plutonium, and maybe it's theoretically possible to do a gun-type nuke with a plutonium, with plutonium as your bomb fuel. I'm not certain, but it seems as though everyone who makes plutonium nukes, they make an implosion system, which if you ever saw that movie where they steal, was it War Games, or I'm conflating two different movies together? Where he like has the insight. That's the soccer ball shape, the hexagons, and then you'd have high explosive lenses timed just right to set off an implosion and a chain reaction. It's very difficult to get right, and so far they've had apparently like three pseudo detonations, but they've got their nuclear deterrent. And it was all because of the Americans took this tough guy approach of everything we say, all or nothing, we're the dictators, and you're the pygmy. That's what Bush called Kim Jong-il. He's a pygmy. Not that Bush is racist against short little African people or anything like that. What he meant was you're subhuman. Not that Bush thinks that Africans are subhuman or anything. But he was just, you know, trying to piss this guy off and accomplish nothing with it. And now, it's funny, actually, to read all the hawks who pretend that they're so scared of the Iranian nuclear program, who are trying to cite North Korea as the example of what other than their worst failure. And what do they have to say? And then they're saying that that is the path that we should follow with Iran, no matter the fact that they're still within the non-proliferation treaty. They still are within their safeguards agreement. They still are verified to have not diverted any of their nuclear material to any military or other special purpose, where even the CIA and all the other American intelligence agencies agree, and so do the Israeli intelligence agencies agree, that they have not decided to try to make nukes. I mean, what they're doing now, they're building up what's called a breakout capability, or they have been, or a pseudo breakout capability that, you know, theoretically they're good enough at the fuel cycle where push came to shove, they could make a nuke. But even that doesn't make any sense. They couldn't do it without everyone knowing. They couldn't make a nuke without withdrawing from the treaty, kicking the inspectors out, and everything, just like America successfully forced the North Koreans to do back in 2003. And in fact, I have the clip, and here, let me play it for you, because you might not believe me if you don't know me or whatever, and so I'll just prove it. I have the clip of John Bolton, who was, of course, first at the State Department, and then became the unconfirmed American ambassador to the United Nations. And here he is on a conference call with the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, and notice he refers to them as we. And us, rather than the United States of America. That's where his loyalty lies. What the hell is this, man? I click on it and then nothing happens.
Right. Let me turn now to the question of,
All right, so what happens is he talks at the end. Well, I guess I could play the whole thing. Yeah, I'll just play the whole thing for you here. This is John Bolton, and this is back in like 2006 or something. I'll tell you what you're about to hear, and then that way you'll see that I'm right when I play it. And that is that he says we're trying to get Iran to withdraw from the treaty. We're trying to bludgeon them over the head with this so much that they up and quit. Then we'd have an excuse to bomb them. That's what he means. Anyway, listen.
And what I think the situation is there, Security Council just passed a resolution. The resolution that the Security Council passed at the end of last month imposing certain limited sanctions on Iran, obviously the product of a long effort based on Iran's refusal to comply with the earlier Security Council resolution that gave them until August the 31st to cease their uranium enrichment activities. I'd have to say, because I'm a private citizen and therefore a free man again, and can these are my personal views now, that this resolution, the sanctions resolution, is very disappointing. It is not as tough as I would have liked to have seen it. In many respects, the Russians did an outstanding job from their point of view in protecting Iran, in narrowing the scope of the sanctions, limiting the effectiveness, I think, of many of the things that we wanted to try and do to prevent the Iranians from continuing to make progress on their nuclear and ballistic missile programs. I think the Iranian reaction to the sanctions resolution has been very telling in that respect, although they've passed a resolution in Parliament reevaluate their relationship with the International Atomic Energy Agency. They have not rejected the sanctions resolution. They have not done anything more dramatic, such as withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty or throwing out inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which I actually hoped they would do, that kind of reaction would produce a counter reaction, actually would be more beneficial to us. So
there you go. Trying to bully them out of the treaty. That was the Bush administration approach. And now, so, I mean, this was the problem when the Bush guys took power, right? Was Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, all three. Not that they were allies with each other at all or were any kind of axis at all, but there were three rogue states that the Republicans wanted to kill. And yet all of them were members in good standing of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the International Atomic Energy Agency. And they were all verified to, in the case of Iraq, to not have a nuclear program whatsoever. And in the case of North Korea, to have a suspended one. And in fact, in the case of Iran, they didn't have one yet. But the Americans took the tack that, well, we're just going to straight buffalo everybody into Iraq. We don't even care. We'll tell any ridiculous lie to pretend that there's a nuclear weapons factory somewhere. They keep all the chemical weapons right under Saddam Hussein's bedroom. That way we can't look. Yeah, because that's what he would do, is sleep on top of a pile of chemical weapons. Whatever lie that they could have to come up with to get us into that one. But then with North Korea, I don't know what the hell they thought they were going to get out of this. I mean, that's the whole thing. It's not like we're just disagreeing because gentlemen disagree sometimes. What the hell did Dick Cheney think he was going to get by breaking the deal based on a bunch of lies, by forcing the North Koreans out of the treaty that they were going to attack North Korea and Iraq at the same time? Oh no, they're withdrawing from the treaty and they say they're going to start making nukes now. But they didn't pay any attention to North Korea at all at that point. So what does that mean? Does that mean that somehow Condoleezza Rice won an argument with Cheney at that point? Or Cheney just forgot that he was halfway through picking a fight, but he didn't know what the hell to do with it after that? Or is it that Bush said, let's wait 2 weeks and see how Iraq's going? Uh-oh. So no more wars for now? Or what happened there? They had no plan, I guess. They let John Bolton decide what to do. Meanwhile, if they just stayed with the agreed framework, just like with Iran, if we had a more open policy with them, they would be a different place right now. They'd be coming our way and in many ways.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, Al Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. All right, y'all. Thanks for listening. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Speaking of North Korea, dear leaders on TV talking about the economy right now. Let's not listen. By the way, I swear I'm not going to get completely off track onto this, but I have to mention this story about home prices continuing to rise here. It's at CNN Money. Home prices posted their first double-digit gain in the third quarter since the height of the housing bubble from, second quarter 2012, it was up 1.7%. I guess that means from the height of, before the crash, I don't know. Anyway, they just keep inflating these bubbles. And then, of course, when the whole thing falls apart, they'll blame it on freedom. You know, we just weren't completely done obliterating freedom yet. Otherwise, how else could this have happened? Because everybody knows that a totalitarian state is the best way to run an economy, right? Anyway. God dang it, Bobby. Get the hell out of here. Bubbles. Robert Murphy had this funny piece over there, quoting Paul Krugman, probably not understanding that he's actually conceding to the Austrians. And it's kind of complicated, but not really that complicated. The Democrats, the Keynesians, which are the exact same thing as the Republican Chicago School guys, they all believe the same stuff as each other. Give me a break. They're all a bunch of half commies. Half fascist, maybe, is more like it. Whichever you prefer. Whichever satisfies your slant a little better. But his thing is that deflation is the terrible threat, and we got to keep inflating the money supply. And it's a good thing to keep inflating the money supply. As long as consumer prices on the shelves aren't skyrocketing, then it's fine. Because we're just protecting from the pain of deflation and whatever. Completely ignoring any other part of the economy other than consumer prices, and that bubbles could be caused in other places like higher order goods, which is actually the entire Austrian theory. Or that, you know, some of those prices need to fall because they were up where only funny money had put them in the first place. But anyway, so Krugman, this whole time, his position has been that. And yet now, he gave this talk, as Robert Murphy highlights over there at consultingbyrpm.com, where he is conceding that in the bond market and in housing and construction businesses and some of these higher order things, that there seem to be bubbles going on there. Distortions. And then, of course, I don't want to try to paraphrase Bob. My way of putting it is, his solution still is to just flood the economy with so much money that I guess everything catches up to those smaller bubbles, so they're not really bubbles anymore. They get drowned out by all the bubbles around them somehow or something. Rather than letting bad debts liquidate and then getting on with prices at a market-determined level.
Anyway, it's just, it's funny to me, you know, especially as much as I used to be such a conspiracy theorist and think that, you know, it was such a lie that the way the economy worked, and they're such dictators of the economy. But, and of course that's true, but just that it, whatever they try, it never really works. I mean, sometimes for a while they get away with fooling themselves and others, but they're never right, these master planners. They just don't know. To a great degree, they're victims of their own confirmation bias in the same way as everybody else. They just have a lot more power. And especially when you're pulling down the kind of salary that Federal Reserve, even just the technicians that work there, you know, all the number crunchers and whatever. When you're pulling down that kind of salary, you're basically being told that you're right and you're smart and you're good for something, or else why are you here and why is everybody else agree with you so much and whatever. So the whole thing is a big back padding festival. Hey, did you see us? We were successful in getting home prices to rise, everybody. That's how they talk about it on TV. Hey, look, home prices are rising. Okay, but in this market? Wait, how many unoccupied homes are there in America now? And is there anything we need to know about who's buying the houses in this market right now? Why home prices are rising right now? Anyway, it's not that capitalism, like a real free market libertarian capitalism, would mean fair and wonderful results for all or anything like that. It just means, well, they wouldn't be able to rig distortions like this. The market is the check and balance. The state decision is where basically men in green with guns try to force a price to move where it doesn't belong and keep it there. So maybe the price could be a mean son of a whatever and destroy your life, but still, hiring the government to, you know, keep your, for example, and I don't mean to dumb it down too much, but this counts. This is the same kind of thing. Your, saddle and buggy whip company, when cars are invented, you gotta go. There's just not the demand for saddles and buggy whips anymore. So either you gotta start doing upholstery for new horseless carriage seats, or you gotta go fly a kite, man. But, you know, think about that. Who was the guy that wrote the thing about the, was it Bastiat that talked about the candle maker's petition to get the government to block out the sun so that everybody would be forced to buy their candles and keep their candle prices high? Yeah. Anyway, I guess it's a good time to not really be a home builder, but to temporarily invest in home building companies, since the central bank has decided with their police power to funnel a bunch of capital into that sector of the economy again. No matter how bad it hurt last time around. Amazing. And really, you know, you watch TV, and I'm not an investor class guy. I'm not up to my eyeballs and all this stuff. But really, any fool can see that these CNBC people have no idea what they're talking about. Hey, look at what the number did today. Isn't that great, Bob? Yeah, it's up from yesterday. That is great. Yeah. Isn't that a great? Hey, look, here's the chart since last week. It's up 3 days in a row. That's pretty good, right? Sure is. All right, now here's a commercial for Pillsbury pastries. But nobody knows what the hell they're talking about. It's amazing to me sometimes watching these financial things, which I try not to very often, but God dang, how about some fundamentals here? Are they strong or aren't they? All right. Hey, by the way, especially if you're not one who's inclined to agree with me on economics, but you just love my foreign policy so much, I'm going to go ahead and recommend this speech to you just because it's so much economics in one lesson, kind of a one-stop shopping for catching on to a bunch of stuff that you need to understand. It's from 2006. 2 years before the last giant crash. And it's Peter Schiff, who I actually, well, personally, I don't really like very much, but I do respect his intellect a lot. He's kind of an arrogant jerk, but he's really smart. I don't know. I never invested money with him. I'm not sure if investing with him is a real good idea. But anyway, he sure as hell predicted the housing collapse in 2006. And what it is, and here's some keywords for you. You can't miss it. It's 2006. Make sure you get that one because there are other ones. 2006, Peter Schiff, mortgage bankers. It's like an hour long. You can do it. Take the time out and watch that speech. Because what it is it's the housing bubble. It's the investors in the housing bubble in Las Vegas at a giant housing bubble banker convention. And Peter Schiff is the naysayer. They're all there telling each other how smart and rich they are. Man, you getting rich? Me too. Aren't we smart? Hell yeah, we are. Look at how rich we are. And Peter Schiff gets up there and says, you guys are damned fools. You don't have any idea what you're doing. In fact, you don't know nothing about how the economy works. So let me teach you about how the economy works, all right? And what's great about that is, what's great about who his audience is that he can be a little bit brutal and he can expect that they're big boys, they can take it. They invited him there to red team them. They invited him there to be the naysayer. And again, they're all a bunch of really rich, really smart guys who know exactly what the hell they're doing. And they're, in other words, big boys. And so it's okay for him to go ahead and be a little bit rude, push the limit a little bit, and say, look, man, here's what you're not getting. And he completely schools them. This is what wealth is. This is where wealth comes from, okay? And this is what happens when you have a government in charge of an economy. And this is what they're doing to us. And this is why you need to get the hell out of housing right now. And it's funny because one of the guys says, well, hey, I own 10 houses in Phoenix. What should I do? Slip my wrist? And he says, sell your houses in Phoenix. Sell them to some sucker who's not here today to hear it, man. Fast as you can. Never recommend suicide, but you should get out of flipping houses right now. And you know what? That's back on TV all the time now, right? All the flip this house shows are back on TV. All of a sudden, it's a great investment to take out a 0% mortgage to buy a house, improve it a little, and flip it for more to someone else who's going to just try to flip it again. Everybody speculate now. We'll all be rich for a little while. I need to get in on some of these bubbles. All I ever do is complain. Since the 1990s, I was telling young millionaires in my cab, you idiot, this is a giant bubble. They're not going to keep shoveling free money at you for nothing all day. You need to cash those options in and get the hell out of there, pal. They wouldn't listen. But I should have been listening to myself. I had to get in this, day trade a little, and then skedaddle. I could have done that two or three times, been rich as Barack Obama by now. Oh, he's a rich man. Yeah, somehow. I'm not sure what he did, but all of a sudden he's a zillionaire. Well, he sold some books, but I'm pretty sure he still only makes 100 grand or two to be the president, right? All right. Sorry, I spent too long in the economy. I just think it's funny when they celebrate. Here the economy's in a total slump all the way around. Everybody feels it. And then, but yeah, people are building and buying more and more houses. Really? And that's good? That makes sense? That's the natural result of decisions they're making on a free market? Or that's what happens when you flood certain sectors of the economy with free money? Free currency, not wealth. Not real capital, see, just pseudo-capital. Stand-in capital. All right. Okay, now Munich. I got to talk about the Munich thing again. That's what I should have started with. Munich, Munich, Munich. Oh, Barack Obama is Neville Chamberlain, and Rouhani is Hitler, and Munich. What's funny is, actually, most of the talk about Munich, they don't even get into it. Everybody knows that Munich means sellout. But they don't even really draw the metaphor out at all. They just assume everybody already knows what that means and they already agree. Oh, Munich. Munich is what happens when you do anything other than kill everybody. Well, what does that even mean? Munich is where Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister of Britain, went and made a deal with Hitler that, what was it? You took the Sudetenland, but don't take any more than that in Czechoslovakia. Don't go further and take Czechoslovakia or whatever. I forget exactly. Something like that. Anyway, so Hitler waited half a year or something and went ahead into Czechoslovakia too. And so Neville Chamberlain was humiliated and gave a war guarantee to Poland, and the Polish colonels immediately declared war on Britain's behalf, basically. And the world was plunged into World War II. That's not really right. Hitler was the aggressor, but Chamberlain really screwed up by giving the Polish the war guarantee, which made them thinking that that will dissuade Hitler from trying to pull the same thing in Poland. All it did was make sure that Britain was on the hook when he did the exact same thing in Poland anyway, basically. When there was no real reason why Britain had to care. It's not like they were about to field an army into Poland any more than they were about to field an army into Czechoslovakia. And as far as the whole sellout to Hitler, he was a madman and he was going to take over the whole world, maybe, but he was going east first. And the British really screwed up by turning him west first. Hitler ended up making a deal with the USSR to carve Poland in half. He had to bide his time and deal with the British and the French first before he could then turn on the Soviets. When he should have went to the Soviets first and maybe never made his way back east, maybe just got snowed in the suburbs of Moscow. But anyway, the people who argue even about Munich itself, never mind the metaphor and the analogy yet, but even about the Munich deal itself, the only real criticism that they can levy is that Neville Chamberlain foolishly claimed, oh, I know how to deal with this Hitler guy, and I have brought us peace in our time because I'm so great. Well, so, okay, that was really stupid. And in fact, that's what led to him flying off the handle when Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia anyway. And give the war guarantee to Poland, foolishly give the war guarantee to Poland, was based on his embarrassment for having stated so foolishly that he could tell Hitler what to do, when ain't nobody tell that guy what to do. He kind of already had his own ideas. And, but nobody, no Republican that I've ever heard even argues that, yes, what should have happened is Roosevelt should have declared war against Germany at that point, and so should Britain have, and the whole world at that point. As soon as Germany invaded Czechoslovakia, the whole world should have invaded Germany then. Is that the lesson of Munich? Does that make any sense whatsoever, really? Does anybody actually believe that? Or what the hell, when you actually ask the question and wait for an honest answer, what is supposed to be the lesson of Munich here anyway? That every nation state in the world should have given an alliance, a treaty alliance, to Czechoslovakia to guarantee their sovereignty against the Germans forever and no matter what the cost. Is that it? It doesn't make any sense. And then they turn around and they say, everything is Munich. Anybody letting anyone get away with anything short of dying is Munich, according to the neoconservatives, according to the Israel lobby in America, and for that matter, the right-wing hawks, they're parroting puppets who have no brains, but just a little stem that they can repeat things like a minor bird. But who's appeasing who in this Iran thing? Obviously, America is the world-conquering evil empire here, and they're the ones appeasing us. But what choice do they have? They're giving up almost everything in exchange for the slightest bit of relief and the promise of a little bit more, maybe. But we're supposed to think somehow that that makes Iran, Germany, that makes the Ayatollah Adolf Hitler, the fanatic lunatic. I mean, come on, man. The Ayatollah, he's a Republican son of a bitch. I ain't saying that, but man, Hitler? And where's his Wehrmacht? And where's his Luftwaffe? He might have a Gestapo, but he doesn't have a Wehrmacht. And anyway, the whole thing is stupid. The whole thing is ridiculous. And it reminds me of a couple of years, few years back now, when Chris Matthews interviewed one of these Republican blowhard radio hosts talking about something was Munich, ever leaving Iraq or something. Munich, Munich, Munich. And Chris Matthews said to him, oh yeah, what's Munich? And I think he gave it to him. Yeah, no, it's a city. Okay, we know. But what happened there? What does that mean? And the guy says, Yeah, exactly. That's like the rest of you. Everything is Munich. Everything led to Hitler taking over the whole world. Everything other than starting the war that right-wing hawks want at whatever moment they want one. I don't know. It's not like I feel like Charlie Brown and Lucy in the football scenario here, but it seems like, you know, because I never worked on me. But for those of you who this has ever worked on, don't it kind of annoy you that people think about you that they can just give you some one word, little slogan, some key word to try to trip your emotion and make you not think, make you surrender your thinking to them? Munich, Munich, Hitler, scary, bloody, danger. I don't know. That just makes me extra not afraid. That just makes me think that whoever's trying that on me has got no real argument at all. What are you kidding? I don't know. I guess it works. The focus group show. People like being scared. They have a whole kind of movie like that. It's called the horror movie. Also, chick flicks, but that's different. It's just for scaring the crap out of you. You know? It's fun. It's kind of a thrill. People like to be afraid. All right. So, anyway, I don't know if I did a very good job of debunking the Munich thing, but apparently it's the thought that counts is all that matters. And not the effectiveness, so that's good. I got that going for me. All right, so here's John Glazer writing at antiwar.com/blog. Four emerging myths about the Iran P5+1 deal. Especially for those of you who listen to a lot of right-wing radio and media, you probably need to listen up to this for just a second. Here are some myths to watch out for. Iran got too much sanctions relief. Actually, Iran got almost no sanctions relief. The bulk of the goods for Iran is that they got about $7 billion of their own overseas assets out of approximately $100 billion unfrozen. Some minor, that's less than 10% of it, some minor negligible sanctions were eased on gold and precious metal transactions and to facilitate the delivery of spare parts for Iran's outmoded airplanes. These will have little positive effect on the Iranian economy, which is a large part of Rouhani's domestic selling point for diplomacy. The crippling economic sanctions on Iran's oil and banking sectors, widely considered the most devastating, remain in place. And that is a fact. And it's the sanctions on the banking, especially, because what that means is no shipping company wants to have anything to do with them whatsoever, no matter what. Just forget it. We're not delivering nothing. We're not bringing wheat. We're not bringing medicine. We're not bringing refined gasoline. We're not bringing hot pants. We're not bringing a thing to Iran, because who wants their corporation to go up against the American treasury on the warpath against transactions with Iran? Even if you're within all the rules and regulations, you want to mess with them? You run some zillion-dollar shipping company, and so they go without medicine. Two, Iran's enrichment program is left largely intact, leaving room for Iran to cheat. That's myth two.
This deal freezes or rolls back the entirety of Iran's uranium enrichment program. Half its stockpile of 20% enriched uranium, the aspect of the nuclear program most cited by Iran hawks, will be oxidized, and the other half will be irreversibly converted into fuel rods for the Tehran research reactor. For the whole of the six-month period over which this agreement reigns, Iran agrees not to enrich any uranium past 5%. Furthermore, no further advances will be made at the facilities at Natanz, Fordo, or Iraq. Not Iraq, Iraq. That's a town there where they got a facility. Heavy water reactor. And finally, under construction. And finally, declared facilities will be inspected daily, not weekly, daily, to ensure compliance. Iran has no incentive to cheat. The hawks' argument that Iran will use this interim deal to break out and dash for a nuclear weapon are foolish and illogical. The Iranian regime has staked its domestic and international credibility on this diplomatic path. If it falls apart because they defied the very deal they pushed for and agreed to, they'd look ridiculous. Moreover, it's clearly preferable in the Iran cost-benefit analysis to willingly roll back their enrichment program in exchange for thorough sanctions relief and greater international prestige arising out of their acknowledged cooperation. And, you know, he could have added, especially since they never were making nukes anyway, and the whole thing is such a big, bogus issue anyway, why not go ahead? You know what I mean? It's like if you ran a gun shop, but all you sold was a few shotguns. And yet the ATF was always breathing down your neck as though you were dealing AK-47s to criminals all day. And you just said, okay, look, man, just park one of your guys in my office and watch me, you know? Please. I'm just a lowly shotgun salesman, you might say. That's what's going on here. They certainly have no incentive to cheat at all. He's certainly right about that. And I'm not criticizing him. I'm just saying he left that part out, but he could well have finished his sentence that way. Especially since they ain't doing nothing wrong anyway. If they can get some sanctions relief for double extra super proving it, then why in the hell not? All right. That's John Glazer. And you know, I had somebody on my Facebook page who I've seen around for a while, and he must have friended me at some point, but he said, well, let me see if I got this right. And he repeated what he's been hearing on Right Wing Talk Radio or an article that he read at Newsmax or WorldNet Daily or Fox News or something. It's what the right-wingers are telling each other right now, and it was totally ridiculous. It was, and no offense to the guy, because he was like, hey, thanks a lot for the help, you know? He was honest about it. And in fact, that's how he started, was he said, let me see if I have this right. And he wasn't being sarcastic, I don't think. He was saying, let me see if I have this right. Is this right that we're giving them tax money? No, we're giving them a little bit of their money that our government stole from them. We're giving them a little bit of it back. That's not the same thing as taking money out of our paychecks and giving it to them. Totally different. Oh, okay. And they hardly gave up anything? No, no. They gave up almost everything, man. They're going to turn the Fordo facility into like a research facility. They're basically turning that thing off, or almost off. They're going to convert all of their mid-range enriched uranium. It's technically highly enriched uranium, but it's only 20%. But still, they're going to divert all of that in such a way that it can never be used for nukes, even if they wanted to use it for nukes. And that is converting it to fuel plates, fuel rods. I'm not exactly sure the discrepancy there. And also oxidizing the rest. So that's the big pretended worry is, oh, it just takes the snap of a fingers to go from 20% to 94%. Not that that's true, but that's a slogan a lot of people had memorized. So this leaves them down with only what they have at 5%. And then that's going to be, they're going to turn off a lot of their centrifuges, scale back what they're doing at Natanz, and allow for much more inspections. And then presumably, if they're allowed to continue with their peaceful nuclear program from here, they will use that stockpile of uranium to fuel more nuclear reactors. And again, if you leave all the demagoguing and nonsense aside and just think like a businessman for a minute, which that may be hard for Iranian politicians to do, but I think there are Iranian politicians who are looking at this like a businessman saying, not just do we want these sanctions lifted, but I mean,
before that, why they want, assuming they can get the sanctions lifted, why they want nuclear power is because they can burn their uranium and sell their oil. There's not much of a market for selling uranium. There's no money in that. There's lots of money in selling your oil. So they can burn their uranium and sell their oil. And it's just a matter of opportunity cost. So I'm not saying it's the perfect economic decision or whatever, but I think the numbers, actually in the past people have looked into the numbers here, and it makes perfect sense for them to do this. It's not like it's really even iffy, I don't think. They could make plenty of money selling their oil and not burning it on their domestic electricity consumption. As a national strategy, you know. As a national Ayatollah energy policy. It makes perfect sense for them to want nuclear power, other than to make nukes. Which again, and I've said this a million times, but it's true and it's important, so I keep saying it. The only reason, according to Seymour Hersh and his intelligence sources, they believe, the CIA believes, well, they had decided, some of them anyway. I don't know if this was in an official report or not, but they had decided among themselves anyway that the only reason they were even really thinking about getting a nuclear bomb was to maybe keep Saddam out in case America ever hired Saddam Hussein to invade them again like Jimmy Carter did in 1980. And in case that ever happened, maybe they would have to use a nuke to keep Saddam out instead of sending an entire generation of young kids with no guns to go get massacred like what happened last time. 500,000 of them killed or something. But then after America got rid of Saddam for them, Ahmed Chalabi was working for Iran, lied America into war, told Israel's fifth column in America that it would be good for Israel. So they lied the American people into a war they thought for Israel, but in fact for Iran. Which, of course, that's why so many American sons and daughters, too, died fighting to put the Ayatollah Muqtada al-Sadr, or soon to be Ayatollah Muqtada al-Sadr in power there in Baghdad, and Ayatollah Sistani and whatever they compromise on. But anyway, so that was the only reason they were ever thinking about needing nukes, was to keep Saddam out. Well, now the Shiites control Baghdad, so they have no kind of threat to the West at all. We completely took care of that and, in fact, expanded their influence into Iraq in ways they could have never imagined would have come true probably back in 2002. And then, and everybody knows that Israel has at least hundreds of nukes, you know, at least 200, a couple hundred, maybe many more than that, and nuclear submarines, whatever. They know they can't take Israel on in some kind of nuclear war. They wouldn't even think of that. Even if Israel didn't have the United States to rely on, which they do, they wouldn't even think about that. That is so stupid. You'd have to be Jennifer Rubin to believe that, oh yeah, they just want to commit complete national suicide by H-bomb for their religious beliefs. Yeah, right. That's so stupid. I can't believe they published that crap in the Post. But anyway, yeah, they're going to get themselves blown up in the process of trying to see if they can make one nuke, huh? Yeah, what a brilliant national strategy the American hawks assume the Iranians have. Oh, and by the way, I meant saying, I know I skipped the last break because I wanted to complain more and not stop. But I was saying earlier, but I got interrupted by the top of the hour break, I guess, about how if we made a deal with North Korea, if Bush had been cool, if they had just gone with the Colin Powell plan on North Korea in the Bush years, and, you know, maybe even tried to improve upon that, all other things being equal, they might have really been able to make some progress in chipping away at the communist totalitarian dictatorship of the DPRK. You know, this kind of thing with Dennis Rodman and the Harlem Globetrotters going over there as they did earlier this year, that's the kind of thing that can bring down a totalitarian regime. That's probably the thing most likely to bring down a totalitarian regime. You know, these people need to be tempted with better. You know, a lot of North Koreans presumably anyway, due to the propaganda, are under the impression that the rest of the world has it a hell of a lot worse off than they do, and that their country is providing aid to the rest of the world, which is on its knees starving all day because of the evil capitalists who take everything and whatever. They don't know that a bum in America is doing fine compared to the best of them, compared to their ministers, you know? And sending Dennis Rodman over there just to trip everybody out, you know, and have some fun playing some ball and just showing them some free spirit and that kind of thing can go so far. Remember, in the 1980s, in the Soviet Union, the communists were the conservatives. And the capitalists and the pro-Westerners were the young, hip liberals. Saying enough, and I'm sorry to use the word hip there, because I'm not sure that even counts, and I don't even like that word or you ever use it. But they were the new and interesting. And it was the communists who were the old right, the hard, mean old right. I don't mean the old right like the American old right. I just mean the crotchety old bastards. The conservatives. And so, I like to think about those kinds of things, man. The counterfactual. What if Harry Brown had been the president instead of George Bush? He ran in the year 2000. What if America, instead of being a bunch of nincompoops, fighting, scratching each other's eyes out over Bush versus Gore? Yeah, really. They're so much different, better, worse than each other, huh? Oh, convince me of that, man. Good luck. But anyway, what if everybody had elected Harry Brown instead? And if every time something bad happened, he just gave the Statue of Liberty speech and explained how freedom's going to take care of it and then proved that? I don't know, man. I don't like utopianism because usually utopianism is a prescription, a big plan for a bunch of stuff that ought to happen. But my utopianism is just, wow, what if everybody just backed off and shut up, you know? Leave everybody alone a little bit. Or maybe back off, but keep talking. That would be Harry Brown's way. Hey, North Korea, man, let's be friends, dude. We're lifting all sanctions on you immediately. You want light water reactors? I hereby drop any restrictions on American corporations. Donald Rumsfeld wants to sell you a light water reactor. Let's get it done. Let's work together. We'll send our basketball team, you send your gymnastics girls, and then we'll send our symphony orchestra, and then you send your slave camp victims, or, you know, whatever it is. We'll trade our slave camp victims for yours. We'll do cultural exchanges of totalitarian enslavement. We'll get through this. We'll liberate all of our camps together. It's not perfect. It couldn't have possibly been perfect. But it could have been 100,000 jillion times better than how it was under the Bush regime and under Obama, too, who Obama's basically done nothing to try to fix American problems with North Korea. It's really made matters worse, probably. Well, status quo is bad enough. But it just didn't have to be this way at all. And the people of North Korea could all, virtually all of them, be living better lives now. If the Americans, instead of helping to isolate the Hermit Kingdom, had actually some sincere intentions beyond their own benevolent global hegemony and had done everything. Just think how hard Harry Brown would have tried. He would have sent emissaries, friends, to just try to be peace brokers, right? They wouldn't have had the power to promise that America would do anything, really, as a government. But he would have absolutely encouraged the government of South Korea and the government of North Korea to meet, to lay down train tracks across the DMZ, to lay down roads across the DMZ, to open up more office parks on both sides of the DMZ, to allow more family visits across the DMZ, to allow eventual real sunshine and reunification. Guarantee you that would have been Harry Brown's policy for 8 years. North Korea, stop being such a commie. Let's get along. Hermit Kingdom. This is the 21st century. We don't have time for hermit kingdoms around here. Come on. Lighten up. Loosen up. Let us in. We're sending in our basketball stars. We're sending in scientists to tell you how to grow crops that will grow so you can feed people. I'm going to work this out. I mean, can you imagine what position Kim Jong-il would have been in the whole time? When the American president, Harry Brown, absolutely refuses to get angry, absolutely refuses to be disgusted or frustrated, and just continues to try to kill him with kindness. That would have been something to see. And it would that I'm telling you, man, it would have been like that. It would have been like that. And, you know, that's what Trita was saying in his article, Iran's future is now, is their headline, he said. But in Reuters, he's saying, listen, man, if this deal falls apart, then the hardliners in Iran win. And that means a lot of things other than they win on, say, the future of Iranian nuclear policy and the future of even trying to come to reasonable accommodation with the Americans of any kind. But it also means more hangings, more oppression, more of that right-wing theocratic religious dictatorship that the American right-wing theocratic dictators say that they hate so much, and that the Israeli right-wing theocratic dictators say they hate so much. Isn't that plausible? But he says, hey, listen, man, if you want a new and different and interesting Iran, if you want an Iran that you can continue to deal with into the future, then make this deal. Get it done. And then this will be a huge victory for the moderates. And then they'll get to win on other things, too, inside Iran. Like loosening up their oppressive dictatorship and their persecution of political prisoners and other things. It's not a complete dictatorship. There's some democratic process there, but yeah, about as much of America's for what that's worth, you know? But anyway, so it's the same thing. You do the counterfactual thing about Harry Brown and North Korea for the 2000s. Well, what about if Harry Brown was here right now and in charge of working this thing out with Iran? Because, and the reason, if you don't know who Harry Brown is, then go look him up. Read what he wrote. Watch videos of him talking. Here's the thing about Harry. The guy just oozes sincerity. He was so freaking sincere. Forget about it. He's not lying to you. He really means it. Really a gentle guy. Really good intentions. Very sharp. Very smart man. But the reason I keep saying Harry Brown, I could say Ron Paul too, meaning that when he says it, you know he means it. And so if Ron Paul, maybe that's a more plausible example for y'all, people remember him running just last time, the time before that. If it was Ron Paul, he would tell the Iranians, oh yeah, no, all Cold War is off. I don't care about having a Cold War with you at all. It's over. Consider this a war guarantee, not a war guarantee, a security guarantee, a guarantee of no war. Consider all sanctions lifted. American corporations, consider yourselves free to do business with companies in Iran or the Iranian government or whoever you want. Go ahead. And everybody would know that he meant it. Everyone would know that. Till he goes, you know, riding in an open top car through Dallas on a parade or whatever, that's going to stick. He means what he says about that. And if that was the case, then what the hell, who in the world, who in Persia would listen to some Ayatollah screaming and crying about the great Satan all day? Right? In other words, their neoconservatives, their hawks. Who would listen to their hawks in the face of a Harry Brown or a Ron Paul saying, oh yeah, no, we mean you no harm and we really mean it and you know that. All that great Satan stuff would fall away. Their population is over all that. I mean, they're not, I'm not saying their society is over what happened, necessarily forgive everything what happened with the American-backed dictatorship all those years and all these years of Cold War, but they are over the concept of wanting to continue it badly. And as Treat has said, huge celebrations. Well, I'm talking like a Fox News guy. There were huge celebrations across Iran. People are so happy that this may be the beginning of the end of this Cold War with America and America's, face it, war against their economy. I saw, I'm surprised they played it on CNN. They played it a couple of times yesterday on CNN International anyway. Of the Iranian lady saying, "We are so thankful for this, and we believe, we hope that this means that we will be able to buy medicine now." I mean, they played that one on the loop yesterday. A couple times anyway. So, you know what? We got nowhere to go but up. And all we got to do is stop listening to the right. They're uniformly wrong and bad on Iran, other than at the American Conservative magazine. They, of course, go without saying they're exempted. McCarthy, Larison, Giraldi, they're all right. The rest of the right, just horrible on this stuff. And especially the Republican Party, these people, it's amazing the degree to which they will openly and publicly, shamelessly put the interests of a foreign power, the pretended, ridiculous, false, stupid, lie interests of a foreign power before the good of their own nation. You know, this guy Mark Kirk talking about, "Oh yeah, I heard John Kerry's briefing, and then I got one from the Israelis, huh, and I think if the American, I don't think that if John Kerry told the American people that they should believe him and not the Israelis, that that dog would hunt." Oh, really, huh? Well, why don't you tell us what the Israelis told you, and let's see how long before we laugh it right out of court. Oh, you're just certain that dog won't hunt, huh? Tell me your Israeli war propaganda versus what anyone with 15 minutes and Google could tell you is actually true. And meanwhile, we already know, because it's an absolute fact, that the official position of the Israeli Mossad is the same as the CIA's, that they're not making nukes. And in fact, I think there's a national intelligence estimate over there just on Mark Kirk about what a liar he is. Hi, I'm Mark Kirk. The thing that's most famous about me is I tell lies because that's what Israel wants, because I'm a traitor to America forever. Mark Kirk. Re-elect Mark Kirk. He's happy if your boy dies in a war for Israel because he hates you and your family and your boy, and he loves Israel that much. Re-elect Mark Kirk, traitor to America, disgrace to his entire family and everyone who's ever known him. Republican, traitor. And seriously, go read about his conference call. It's over at Salon.com, which, okay, I don't spend much time there since Greenwald left either. However, they got in on this conference call with Mark Kirk. And you know what? Sure sounds like treason to me. And yeah, I do think Israel is an enemy state, so technically and everything. He's an agent of a foreign power. In the U.S. Congress, trying to stop a peace deal. He should be strung up. I mean, he should be convicted in a court of law and all that crap first. But that's the law. You can read it. Treason. It's a capital offense. In fact, you know, they should just bury him in the Supermax next to Ramzi Youssef. Another terrorist. All right, now let me change the subject because I should have a long time ago. There's important. Well, I don't want to talk about all that. I want to talk about this. I want to make fun of Lara Logan. Actually, I want to make fun of American society for still being caught up in this whole Benghazi thing. You really that concerned about an American ambassador died? Oh my goodness, I saw on TV that I'm supposed to be so concerned about what happened to some ambassador. Really? I mean, is that really working on anybody? Who cares about him? And I don't mean like in the worst way. Like, I'm sorry for anybody dies, whatever. I, you know. But I'm just saying, the faux outrage about this. When it's, and it's the Republicans, the party out of power, out of executive power, and they're willing to go to such lengths to try to scandalize what happened at Benghazi. But they're not willing to go one step beyond the narrative of what happened there that day. What happened there that day? Well, how about some context? The Republicans and the Democrats decided to have a war against Kami Gaddafi, whose one positive trait in his entire life was he was good at keeping Al-Qaeda down. And they bombed him for Al-Qaeda. For Al-Qaeda, outright sworn Zawahiri types, as well as for Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And many of these guys would have been called by this government, even if they weren't outright working for Zarqawi, they would have been called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Being Libyans fighting in Iraq, they would have been Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the terrorists. The worst part of the suicide bombing Sunni insurgency that the Americans fought when they were fighting on behalf of Iran's friends in the last war there. And that's who the Republicans and the Democrats fought that war in Libya for 2 years ago. And that's why they'll only focus on what happened in Benghazi that day 1 year ago, instead of talk about, what the hell are we doing fighting wars for Al-Qaeda? We got no real enemies in the world except the ones we make. And really, like, even when we're attacking Gaddafi, it's not like he was even trying to fight back. He's just running for his life. So that doesn't even really count as a war. War is when two armies are fighting. The only real enemy we've been able... The only real enemy our government has been successful in making for itself this whole time is Al-Qaeda. And then we go fighting wars for them. And then we got a bunch of Republicans screaming and crying about what happened in Benghazi without talking about the fact that they were the ones just as guilty as Obama who put this ambassador in the center of the hornet's nest. Just because you fight a war for Al-Qaeda doesn't mean they love you now. It just means that you've given them more power and more guns now, that's all. They still hate you. And actually, Rachel Maddow, Obama's number one worst apologist in America, got this right before she got her talking points. When she pointed out that Ayman al-Zawahiri, hiding out in Pakistan, had put out a podcast asking the Mujahideen of Libya to avenge the death of their fellow Libyan Mujahideen warrior, Sheikh Yahya al-Libi, who was killed by a drone strike in June 2012 in Pakistan. And Zawahiri said, hey, we have this brave holy warrior here fighting with us in Pakistan. He was from Libya. And the cowardly Americans, they killed him with a drone. And so, if you're a Libyan Al-Qaeda guy, and you see Americans nearby, do the right thing. That's what he told them. There's your explanation. But meanwhile, what do we get? We get screaming and crying to the ends of the earth, including fabricated stories about minor detail, extra outrages about what happened at Benghazi that day, September 11, 2012. And still, without any of the context, you overthrew the wacky colonel that was holding the country together and keeping the Salafist jihadist warriors down. And then you turn the country into Salafist jihadi warrior land, and you got your ambassador killed, and there is no nation state in Libya at all anymore. It's splitting apart as we speak, and people are dying in horrible violence as we speak, and you Republicans suck. You might as well be Barack Obama. And it's true that they didn't quite pass an authorization for that war. But then again, they didn't pass the thing demanding that Obama stop it either. And they all went along with pretending that let's change the subject to the phony debt ceiling bull crap, as though there's such a thing as a debt ceiling that they wouldn't raise. Give me a break. But they succeed in changing the subject to that and never talking about Libya authorization again. So at least the leadership of the Republican Party and all of those loyal to them, they're just as guilty as Obama for the Benghazi thing. And then as far as Lara Logan, yeah, guess what? She's full of crap. Really, I'm so surprised. Well, she's mildly attractive, so I'm supposed to take her seriously, I guess, or something, because otherwise that would be sexist. Or something. But meanwhile, she's nothing but full of bull crap. She's never told any story that wasn't about how we need war, more war, and how her husband and her family ought to make more money off of it. Oh, I'm so impressed by her South African accent. How exotic for a blonde lady to talk in some kind of weird British sounding sort of thing and telling me war lies for years on end. People going off about this thing on 60 Minutes. I didn't even know people still watch 60 Minutes. People watch 60 Minutes? Have they done a story about anything that mattered in 10 years? Are you kidding? I can't think of a single story that came out of them. And you know, occasionally you'll have the White House will give NBC something really explosive about the MEK or something, right? But when did anyone ever give 60 Minutes anything that mattered at all since back when they were busting the tobacco companies or whatever? 60 Minutes is pathetic. Bunch of true crime stories. Small town America. A husband kills his wife and almost gets away with it. Episode 10 million zillion. Wowee, guys. Great journalism. You had me really cliffhanging at that last commercial break. And also, I want to apologize to Max Blumenthal, and I want to congratulate Max Blumenthal. I apologize to Max Blumenthal that it's taken me so damn long to read his book. But I am reading it, and I really like it, and I highly recommend it, and I don't agree with all of it. But I can't wait till I'm done reading it, and I can get Max Blumenthal on the show, and we can hash this stuff out a little bit. I think I do agree with pretty much all of it. It's so good. He's just put 4 years of badass journalism in there, and you may have heard that there's something wrong with that thing, but I would just add that you have now heard that there's something right with that thing, and that's why people are telling you it's so wrong. I think you ought to take a look and judge for yourself. It's long, but it's compelling. I don't see myself having any problem finishing it, just in a timely fashion is all. It's thick and the letters are small, but it's a hell of a thing. Goliath. Life and Loathing in Greater Israel by Max Blumenthal. By his enemies, you shall know him, and you shall see what a good guy he is. Our good friend Max, and I promise I'll have him on as soon as I'm done with that thing. That's it for the show today. One more tomorrow, and then happy Thanksgiving.